You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestall. This week, author and researcher Andy McGraw joins me to discuss a variety of topics, from cryptids from around the world, his involvement in the new Weird Britain series, and much, much more. From Nessie to Bigfoot, the Yeren to the paranormal, we cover a variety of strange phenomena from around the world. And a big thank you to Andy for joining me on this week's show. Before that, as always, though, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, guaranteed early releases, bonus content, and more. You can also click the link in the show notes as usual, and thank you to each and every one of my patrons for their continued and much-valued support. Thank you. Mysteries and Monsters is across all social media platforms. Please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. And don't forget, you can visit mysteriesandmonsters.com for news, episodes, and merchandise. Weary Pines are the incredible artists that supply our intro and outro music. Thank you as always to Dean Bestall for his marvellous artwork. The show is produced by Bren Store of the Ghost Story Guys, and Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange Network. Now, let's join Andy McGraw to discuss cryptids and more. Today, I'm delighted to welcome author, investigator and researcher Andy McGraw. With two books under his belt, Andy is currently filming with the Weird Britain crew around this merry isle, hunting out witnesses and locations, and along with his podcast, Beastly Theories, Andy certainly has plenty to keep him busy. Andy, welcome to Mysteries and Monsters.
Paul, I am overjoyed to be here. This is like a dream for me, bucket list. and I mean that. I genuinely mean that. I love the podcast, and I'm just really happy to be a part of one of them.
Thank you. Well, that's great praise, because I know you've spoken to Cliff and Bobo before, so I'm in esteemed company, Andy.
Oh, well, you know, those guys are very, very nice, and it's a bit disarming, actually, because I think when you've got your heroes and your stars, and you forget that they're real people, and when you meet those, especially those two guys, they just act like people you meet in the pub, and they're very nice and down to earth and treat everybody the same as any human should. Mm-hmm. But it's like, oh, okay, so we're mates now. I didn't see that coming. Thanks so much.
Well, I think it is strange, because I think a little bit like me, Andy, you've kind of come to this subject. Obviously, you've been chasing things down for the best part of nearly three decades now. But I think sometimes when we're sort of coming from the outside in, we can sometimes get a little bit starstruck. I have to say, there have been a couple of interviews that I've done over the years where I've basically had to sit here and pinch myself as I'm having a conversation with somebody that I look up to immensely.
No, I would agree with that as well. But I just, you know, you probably will become one of those guys at some point. You know, this podcast is really, really popular. People really like it, listen to it all over the world. And at some point, some stranger from another country is going to bump into you and say, it's Paul Bestall, you know? And you're just Paul Bestall. Nothing special to you. Excuse me. So, you know, it's going to be a strange experience. I've never really had that. I've had one or two people say they like the voice for some reason, especially the Americans. Mm. They want me to keep talking and saying things in the voice. And I realized early on when I was getting invited to all these podcasts, when I wasn't really very informed about a lot of the subjects I was talking about, is that they weren't really listening to me. They just were listening to me. It was a really strange thing. It felt a bit sort of objectified. And yeah, it was odd. But yeah, still. You're just Paul Bestall. I'm just Andy McGraw. But if we become the Bobos and Cliffs of the future, it won't change how we feel about ourselves, will it?
No, not at all. I have to say, I did my first talk at a conference last month, Andy, and I was asked by an 8-year-old for an autograph, which just made me, so I had to go and sit down afterwards.
That's amazing, because kids don't lie, at least not about things they like.
Yeah, exactly.
What a privilege.
Absolutely, yeah. It made my year that day. It was amazing, and she'd made her mum. I mean, her mum listened to the show as well, but they'd come 50 miles to see me. So I was just like, whoa, this is crazy.
That's wonderful. What happened to me? There was one thing. When I was doing the Beastly Theories podcast at the beginning, I did it for about a year and I stopped because essentially it was, as it's described in its blurb and its write-up, it's just an act of nepotism to talk to people I'm interested in.
Yes.
And it's really shabby and it's not really produced or edited or anything. It's just, you know, the voices come on and start speaking. So I didn't think anybody ever really listened to it. And then I had this email from these married couple who were fishing in the Bering Strait in Alaska. That was their business, their profession. Mm. And they said, can you do some more shows? Because we like to listen to you when we're in the Strait fishing. And I thought, that's really odd. I'm there. My voice is there floating in the Bering Strait.
Mm.
When you're bringing fish on board. And I just, that's so weird. Okay. And it also made me sort of pull my socks up slightly as well, because I realized somebody actually was listening to it. I could just do whatever I wanted, whatever I wanted.
Yeah. Well, you have had some incredible guests, Andy, over the years. I mean, you've had people on that I've never heard of, which I think is always one of those great things about this, because I'm a big believer in, We can never know too much, to be honest. And I think, especially outside of the UK, a lot of cryptozoological research and writing tends to focus on North America. Whereas since I've done this show and met a lot of people and read a lot more, I've started to get a real appetite for trying to unpick the rest of the world outside of probably Australia and here. Andy, I think a lot of places just get overlooked, primarily, I think, because of the language barrier.
I think you're right about that. I have tried with a few other places in Europe, Spain, Portugal. Even have a chap who's allegedly seen the Yeti, Indian chap from the Lower Himalayas. I'm going to be talking to soon. I think his name is Saratak Halder. Mm. He seems like a very interesting guy. And I wanted to get in touch with some of the Chinese Yeren researchers as well. But as you say, oftentimes, the language is a real barrier. I was going to speak to Michelle Ballow, who's been searching for Makili Mbembe from the Cameroonian side for a long time. And he recently did a documentary with Alex Belcha. I think the guy's name is, lovely guy, director. And of course, Michelle never answered my emails and thought, well, he doesn't, yeah, I'm too little. He doesn't want to speak to me. He can't speak English. The English speaker doesn't think that way.
Mm.
He's not answering because he doesn't know what you're saying. And eventually Michelle answered me. Alex answered me and said, look, I'll do it. And I was there. I know his research. We've just done the movie. I'll think I'd come on. And it was some other people, another guy who's looking for the Almasti.
Yes.
Jean-Marie Moret, I think.
Yes.
Moret.
Yeah.
Of course. And he just came back to me very nice, obviously with Google Translate of some kind, and said, my English isn't great, so I can't really chat to you. I'm so sorry. And it feels like I want to learn all of these languages so I can get them on.
Yes.
And get the interview done, you know, or something like that anyway.
Yeah, yeah. It is. I mean, it's one of those things, I think, over the years. I think when we look at places, Japan, I think, is a real one, Andy, because there's clearly a lot of interest in the weird and wonderful, regardless of whether it's ghosts or UFOs or cryptids. Japan has a real interest in this, because as long as I've been watching television about strange things, there always seems to have been a Japanese film crew turning up all over the world. So there's clearly a massive appetite for these subjects there. And we just can't seem to get in because very few people can speak Japanese outside of Japan.
Oh, and exactly. I mean, it's such a difficult language as well. I had a friend who was learning once upon a time, and I grew up in a martial arts family. We had like a, what was it? Not an academy, but a federation that I think 15, 60 members of my own family were part of.
Mm.
And we were sort of forced into it from a young age. And there were phrases and bits and pieces you got used to, but you find out they've actually got 10 forms of politeness, which are to be used depending upon the station of the person that you're talking to. But then you can't really ask the station, you have to guess it. You could get it wrong, insult somebody, and you're blah, blah, blah. Difficult. You know, if we thought we were sort of awkward and polite as English people, this is next level stuff. So I think there's a lot to it. I would like to get over there and meet maybe somebody who's investigating Issy, you know, the monster of Lake Ikenda, or the Honshu Wolf, or the Capra, and all these wonderful things that they have there that's, you know, semi-folkloric as well, and just, you know, get them on camera with a translator if need be and say, look, what's going on here? And, you know, do we have some common ground? Is it like Nessie, or is this just something that you've adopted, the Nessie image, that is because of the popularity of that beast? You know, has it been Nessified over time like everything else?
It is frustrating as well, because I remember seeing Josh Gates did one of his Expedition Unknowns into the Himalayas searching for the Yeti, because obviously he's stumbled across footprints in the past. So Josh is fully on board with something strange running about in that particular area, Andy. And it was a big two-parter. It's like a four-hour thing. It's incredible. But part of that, they had this footage that had been caught by a Japanese documentary crew, which I've never seen shown anywhere else over here. And it's clearly something standing up and walking on two legs, you know, at a massively high elevation. And they're probably a good 500 yards away from whatever it is. And you just think, that's jaw-dropping footage. Why is this not more well-known? And I think, once again, it just comes down to the fact, well, it's Japan.
I think you're right. I think sometimes it's yes, it could be to do with country and language. And strangely, even though we live in a global world, most information doesn't disseminate through the language barriers. But saying that, verily, there's also copyright involved and possession over the proof, the material, and people want to make money off of it. So a network owns it, perhaps, and is not willing to just farm it out to anybody else who might want it, unless there's some money involved. And people say, well, fair enough. You know, it's like all of these production companies, we can't really afford to pay for that right now. We'll skip it. And maybe pick it up in series two if we get paid some proper money.
I mean, I was really interested when I saw that you'd spoken to a couple of Iberian researchers. I think, was it Ignacio Gallo Campos and Ruiz Sotaro? Because, well, as we're discussing here, Andy, Spain and Portugal especially tend to get overlooked a lot as well, because I think most people focus on Eastern Europe, Germany, Scandinavia, obviously, with its hit story of lake monsters and trolls and all kinds of things, tends to pull us. The south of Europe, even as close as we all are, is a place. It's near enough on our doorstep, and yet it's consistently overlooked. So I was really impressed to hear you speak with both of those researchers, because they're subjects I wasn't particularly aware of.
Well, I think when it comes to wild men in Europe especially, there seems to be a type. I was identifying this when I was writing my Hairy Humanoids book from the Beast of the World series. That was looking at Bigfoot-like creatures all over the world, and it's theorized that it were perhaps types, in the same way as Jeff Meldrum talked about it, you know, giant man-apes, wild men, and monkey monsters, Littlefoots, all that kind of thing. And the European type and the Central Asian type as well seem to be a sort of a wild man type, you know, Neanderthal-like in appearance. And these reports, the ones we had in Britain from years ago, and the carvings and the churches that we know as the Woodwows, and occasionally it's the Green Man, seem to correspond with those in France as well, and those in Portugal and Spain and parts of Germany, all the way across to the Caucasus and beyond. And I just thought, well, this is interesting. I wonder if they've got similar stories. And they do have similar old stories of these wild men, like the Basajon in the Basque Country, and the Catalan one, which escapes my memory right now. I forget the name of it, or whatever that's called. That's completely gone. Sorry. But the Catalan Bigfoot as well. And there's other similar types. There's also types in Portugal that Rui was telling me about, that they have a type there too. Now, this, you know, corresponds with all of Europe, and whether it's because there's a folklore of somebody like, let's say it's something like Sylvanus, the shepherd god, as it would be in the Basque Country, or an embodiment of Heracles, you know, the hero, big hair-covered man carrying a club, as they're also often purported to do, these wild men types, and they're depicted as carrying clubs in the old medieval carvings and tapestries. Whatever it is we're looking at, this is a shared history or folklore of this creature that all of the Europeans and some of the Central Asians seem to have as well. And it always has this similar appearance. It just intrigued me. And I thought, well, let's try and get one or two guys who are investigating it and see what they've got to say.
There is some parallels as well with this European history in regards to the wild men. As you say, it is remarkable how well established it is when you go looking for it, Andy. And there's a very similar thing as Rui was saying in regards to dogmen or werewolves. And you think, well, is this just something off the back of everything that's been going off in the northern states of the US? But then you only have to look at Greek mythology, and we've got Lycan. So once again, this is something that's been in Europe for the best part of 2,000 years, and obviously the stories coming from places in Eastern Europe, from Romania and Hungary and the Slovak regions, that they've always had these kind of stories that were always poo-pooed, and yet there is always some kernel of truth from where these stories originate from that's encouraged these people. And there were always stories of dog-headed people that lived on islands in the mythologies. So it's interesting how this has kind of sort of sidestepped everybody else and then just turned up in North America 35, 40 years ago.
I think it's actually more to do with it's a like this pizza effect. You know, we talk about that, you know, where Italians leave Italy and they go to the United States and New York, and then they bring their pizza and their traditions with them, and then, you know, 200 years later or whatever it is, you know, New York style sort of Brooklyn pizza comes back to Italy and they serve it on the shelves there.
Yes.
And I think something like that. So it's less clear with the to us anyway, with the children, you know, of the Anglosphere in a way, you know, Australia, United States, Canada, New Zealand, etc. But from an objective point of view, we can look at something like the Duende, which exists in Portugal, Spain, Central and Southern America. That's a bit of an odd coincidence, isn't it, really? Let's think about that. Those two countries and all of the places they colonized have sightings of this creature. You were talking about King Lycan, of course. Now, he's purported to have eaten human flesh and basically became a wolf, almost as a sort of curse, for 9 years and traveled around like that and lived his whole life like it. And you'll find similar rituals and mythologies in cultures all around the world. And again, in Hairy Humanoids, in the Dogmen section I put into that book, I wrote about some of these legends, like even with things like skinwalkers that do have a lot of wolf-like attributes in some of the stories, as well as at least in the transformative stage, somebody is a man, becomes a wolf. Even with the werehyena in Ethiopia,
yes,
you know, where this is in fact a creature that disguises itself as a human during the daytime, sort of reverse in a way, as opposed to becoming a creature. And there seems to always be this same mythology. You know, somebody is in some way cursed or outside the pale of religion or the local religion. So, for example, in Ethiopia, blacksmiths were often thought to be werewolves, and nearly all blacksmiths were Jews, because that was the only profession, one of the only professions they were allowed to have. They would have had a different religion to the mass of the population there. And therefore, you know, all of your little rumors and bits and pieces and philosophical ideas about what they could become can be put upon them. You know, be careful, don't go past the blacksmith's house. It's probably a Buddha, you know, a weird hyena, and it could change back to its normal form as you pass by and grab you.
I mean, this is one of those parallels that runs through a lot of belief systems around the world, Andy, as well. Like you say, it's classed as some kind of transformation, and you get that in certain tribes in North America. You get that in the belief in witches, predominantly in Mexico. You have this in Eastern Europe, once again, that werewolves and werecats even were considered to be transformed witches. So that when you go into places like Africa, as you mentioned, that one of my most beloved, overlooked strange creatures, which is the werehyena, there are, I think when you start looking at these things, you see, once again, as we were saying about the wild men being so prevalent across Europe, these creatures, this transformation seems to be ingrained in so many cultures that clearly couldn't have cross-pollinated 2,000 years ago, because as far as we're aware, they weren't speaking to each other. So I find the germs of these beliefs as fascinating as the actual tales, because you think, well, how does a tribe in North America have a similar belief to a tribe in Ethiopia?
It is. I mean, it is interesting, but there's another possibility. Now, there's the cross-pollination or the origination of us all goes a lot further back, and these mythologies or these cautionary tales that we've all taken with us as we spread out across the world eventually are inherent to humanity or human nature itself. And that's why we all share them, that we all had a central start out or beginning point at some place in the world, and we spread out at some point, and because we're all affected by the human condition, similar cultures, or probably similar dangers and things we have to face in our lives, we create these cautionary tales. You know, if you go against your religion, if you step outside, if you have premarital sex, if you eat forbidden foods, whatever the thing is, take part in, I don't know, witch-like rituals, then you'll be cursed. You'll be outside of the realm of the community, of the religion, and you'll live, you know, as a cursed animal on the edge of society. The werehyena, as you mentioned, it's a really good one, because we always think of werewolves, but that's a local animal. There are no wolves in that area. So that local animal is the next best choice for the voracious creature that can consume people, and perhaps that's representative of a, you know, part of human nature and our dark side, as it were.
So what was the cryptid that bit you then, Andy? What was the one that gave you the bug? A lot of people will say, you know, depending on your age, some people will say it was Nessie, it was the Yeti. I mean, for me personally, we didn't get many stories about Bigfoot and Sasquatch over here in the UK, so we were predominantly overawed with tales of the Yeti and Nessie more than anything. So was there one particular one that set you off on this crazy path that you find yourself on nearly 30 years later?
For me, I mean, I'm 47 years old, so for me it is Nessie. I'm British as well, so that was the big one that was most accessible, I think, here. I knew something a little bit about Bigfoot and Yeti when I was young, but it still wasn't a huge subject like it. Not like it is now. There wasn't this massive interest in it, and even stories were few and far between growing up. But Nessie was constant, and even recently, when we arranged the big 50-year expedition with Alan McKenna from Loch Ness Exploration to be the documentary team, we were Britain to go there and film, you know, this huge event that he, and I love Alan Tibbetts, he's such a great researcher, that he had organized, and he brought all of the warring researchers and parties together to work together.
Yes.
With his, you know, with that wonderful spirit he's got. When we decided to do that, for me, it was like a dream, but a difficult dream, because I was turning up as the presenter, as the guy without the skin in the game, without the opinion to talk to people about a subject I know a lot about. And we were really fortunate. You know, we grabbed Ken from Ken Gerhard from the US and asked him to come over and sort of be the resident expert for the episode. And yeah, met with everybody, of course, with Steve Felton and Robin Watson and everybody else, Willie Cameron. But it was like the trip of a lifetime, biggest expedition in 50 years, in which I was biting my tongue. It was very hard, very, very hard. more difficult than you can, but you probably understand completely what I mean.
Yes.
And yeah. So tell me about this Nessie thing. Oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that. of course I did. Yes. But it was great. And it'll look really nice. It gave Nessie like a big sort of a 90th birthday celebration, actually, I think. And yeah. That was a nice thing. So yes. Nessie, always Nessie, because again, I think she's the most plausible one that we have. We've got the biggest variety of witnesses and devotees over the years who've just been bitten by this bug and just can't let it go.
It is remarkable the hold it has, as you mentioned there, Steve Felton, whose story is quite remarkable anyway. He just packed in his job and just moved to Scotland and lives in that little caravan by the side of it, making his beautiful little statues. And Steve's just seems to have become something I think we've kind of lost a lot of, especially here in the UK. And we used to have a lot of eccentrics in regards to strange creatures or legends and myths and everything. But I'm, whether it's just me or it's because I'm doing this show and I'm seeing a lot more, I'm really interested how we seem to be sort of embracing our folklore and our myths in a much more positive way than we probably have done in I don't know, the best part of a century.
I think you're right about that. I've seen over the last 6 or 7 years at least, lots of young creators. I don't count myself as that, being middle-aged. Mm-hmm. Lots of young creators coming along and starting stuff like this. Even a great guy called Daniel Lee, who's a Bigfoot researcher in, I think he lives in the Quantucks. And he's 14 years old.
Yeah.
And he's talking to me and he's showing me evidence and, you know, asking for opinions and also being very well informed himself. And I'm looking at this and I'm thinking, this guy has better equipment than me. He's got all the equipment. He's doing better research, like hands down, than I do. And I go, because I'm lazy and I know what I'm looking for. Unless I'm expecting to find something, I'm not dragging all that plaster Paris and water with me. No way. I've got expanding, insulating foam, a piece of cardboard, you know, and a rock, and a little basting brush, you know, with the nice fine ends.
Yes.
If I should ever find something, which I never have, to pop down quickly. And I'm not going to that trouble. I'm sorry. I'm not coming to collect the trail cams anymore after 3 months and trying to find my way back to where I hid them, only to find they've been stolen. I'm doing it. And, you know, he's there. He's got the fire. And he's not the only one. There's plenty of others coming up and doing it and not going to the gods like I did at the beginning, saying, oh, hi, and I'm this researcher. And, you know, I'm asking for your blessing, sort of thing, you know, almost in a way. They're just doing it, saying, well, the information's online. This is the area. I'm just going out there and doing it. I don't need your permission. You don't own it. Here I am. And I like it. I really like that. And they're producing, because of that lack of contamination, so to speak, they're producing better content sometimes.
Mm. Well, I think perhaps as well, as you mentioned there, Andy, they're not constrained by our hero worship of the ones that have gone before, is like you say, like the Hindon and Byrne and
they don't know who they are.
Yeah, precisely, a lot of them. And I think obviously Peter was the last one of the horsemen to pass away earlier this year, sadly. I mean, as I was saying beforehand, it's the most nervous I've ever been when I've spoken to somebody, because I spoke to him when I first started doing the show. And I was literally shaking talking to him. I'm thinking, I'm talking to a 92-year-old man. I'm sure he's absolutely fine and he seems a very nice chap. But I was so nervous. And I think for a lot of these younger people, they've kind of grabbed the bull by the horns, as it were. And because they're so tech smart and savvy and on the ball, they seem to be sort of one step ahead of anybody that's come before them in the last sort of 20 years, because they've got all this technology at their fingertips that would have perhaps changed the game if we guys had had it 30 years ago when we were running about in the dark.
You know, if you got like, what do they call that? A little scope where you can see, it's almost like a thermal scope. You can see footprints with it and all kinds of things.
Yes.
A spectre. I knew that name. Sorry. I don't know it. I will find it out and post it on my page. But you know, they've got these kinds of visual equipment. You've got horoscopes, all these different things. They're looking at all of the possibilities out there. And the tech is cheaper than it's ever been.
Mm.
You know, if you or I, you know, 20 years ago, trying to get something like that, could be, you know, maybe a couple of £1,000, you know?
Yes.
And if you knocked out there the woods, you know, you'd be crying all the way back to the bank. And it would be. And it's just that kind of thing. I was always like, okay, I've got my, you know, I've got my envelopes, I've got my tweezers, I've got my gloves. Yeah, I've got binoculars. I've got something to record sound, but not usually. I'm just using my phone with a microphone pinned on me. And maybe I'm wearing a body cam, maybe, you know, like a GoPro. Perhaps, if I'm feeling really lucky.
Mm.
And as I say, you know, the quick casting kit, and I'm out there and it doesn't even weigh anything. You know, my sandwiches take up more room in my bag. And a notepad and I'm just taking notes. You know, what's here? What can I see? This is the area where the person said they saw something. Well, could something live here? You know, you're basically collecting data. That's all you're doing. And then coming home and trying to collate it into some sort of sensible account, witness account. And these guys, if it's there to find, they're going to get it. They really are.
Do you think sometimes as well, Andy, that when people are wanting to go out or have started going out, sometimes it seems that people get really frustrated really quickly, which I find mystifying if we're talking about searching for animals, because the one thing any interest in biology tells you is animals are very good at hiding from people. They don't tend to hang around something that can shoot them.
That's right. And not only that, I mean, they don't generally want to be around us. Even predators don't prefer us as their prey. That's how much the animals just like humans. Even predators don't want to really eat us. You know, they'd rather just go and find a nice deer or something else that they can sort of chow down on and stay away from the people, because I think, yeah, most animals have a natural fear of us. They can hear us coming a mile off. They can smell us. That's for sure. So when you put up your trail cam, but you know, we put our human stink all over it. Sorry, humans for such a amazing way to describe us. But if I've been there, definitely every animal in the place would be able to smell that a person's been there. You can even see with the deer sometimes when they approach those trail cams, they sniff them and they're thinking, what's that? That's, and then they kind of, you know, jolt back slightly. Oh, what's that smell? And it's us, clearly. Let's put those things there. So let's take an example like the big cats, British big cat phenomenon. Now, yes. I wholeheartedly believe in it.
Yeah.
One, I know too many people with no skin in the game at all who've seen one. Like my sister-in-law recently saw one with both my nieces in a place called Wenvo, which is between Barry and Cardiff in South Wales.
Yes.
And she was driving and they pulled over. They could see this big thing in the field. And she described it to me as a person who's got no interest in this or knowledge of cats really at all. We saw a big black lioness, she said. Now, of course, she didn't see a black lioness at all. She saw an elastic leopard lightly and watched it for 10 minutes. I said, okay, that's fantastic. I said, I think you probably saw a leopard. Did you get the clip or any pictures? Oh, no, I didn't think about that. We were just shocked. We wondered what it was. And I thought, oh, goodness, you know, just oof. That's how these things go always. People are shocked. They're surprised. So let's look at that anyway. This is a creature we know is a real creature. We know they exist. Just question is just, do they exist here? And there's enough people looking for them, and yet we haven't found them conclusively.
Yeah.
What about an animal that's intelligent, like a Bigfoot, you know? What about an animal with probably great hearing, like the Loch Ness Monster appears to have, has been accounted for many times, this reaction to the noise of the boats it seems to have, even before they're in sight. What about that kind of creature that can hide in 700 feet of water, you know? Never going to find that.
Yeah, but I'm still surprised that I think sometimes people just presume that we are so intelligent and have so much technology at our fingertips that there's no way that these creatures can avoid us, or they're just dumb animals, Andy, which I've always perplexes me when we can see so many examples from creatures all across the world of supreme intelligence. I mean, one of the best examples I've stumbled across recently is ravens and crows in Australia, who have worked out how to flip over cane toads to kill them so they don't get poisoned. Now, you can't tell me that these birds have been watching a documentary, right? So they've clearly learnt this and been able to share this knowledge with others around them, that they can all start doing it now. And that alone, even just talking about certain birds in Australia, shows you that if we're talking about the intelligence of creatures, they are far smarter than the average explorer or cryptozoologist who's wandering around a wood late at night believes them to be.
I agree. And what we don't think about is, okay, first of all, if there's one thing animals are not, it's dumb. Am I? Okay. They are smart within their environment. is smart within their confines of what their purpose to do. So, you know, something for the for a crow to flip over a cane toad, that animal has a tiny brain. So how does it figure that out? It figures it out because it's within the parameters of its feeding habits, and it's a smart creature for a bird. Mm-hmm. Similarly with dolphins, look at rats using sticks to activate traps and then get the cheese once the trap's gone off.
Yes.
You know, that kind of thing. All recently, what have we seen in the Straits of Gibraltar? Killer whales disabling the rudder on boats.
Yes.
Because they are annoyed by them. We don't know what's happened. Something's happened. The matriarch has taught them all, boats are bastards. Let's get them all.
Yeah.
And they've gone in and started disabling. And you see it time and time again. And there was an occurrence of it happening, or almost happening, in Scotland, the waters around Scotland as well. And it could have been a killer whale from the same pod. So the question came up, is the information spreading? Are they passing it along somehow? And, you know, I would imagine that's by example, but still, they're intelligent within the parameters of their purpose in the natural world. We don't ask them to fix your plumbing, right?
But yes.
They're smart.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, I was speaking to Max Hawthorne recently, and we were discussing about creatures of the sea in general. And
Chronospicing. I love those books.
Yeah. And obviously, Max has done a lot of research, and he's a international class fisherman. He's not just an armchair writer about these particular subjects. He knows the water better than most. And he was saying that it's remarkable that in North America and Australia you have shark fishermen in the older days who were fully aware of if they were having a quiet day or there were no sharks about, they would just lob some dynamite in the sea and cause an explosion, because they knew the sharks related explosions to dead bodies.
Huh. Wow.
Which, once again, it just shows you how are they learning? Because, you know, with the greatest of respect, I don't think there's that many explosions post-war, really. And so they've clearly learnt it somehow. You can't sort of keep saying, oh, well, it's just muscle memory. But I'm sorry, how does a shark know what an explosion sounds like? And if it does know what it sounds like, why does it then associate it with food?
Yeah. Sharks are animals that rear their young, are they? So all behaviour must be instinctual.
Yeah.
Instinctive.
Yeah.
That's fascinating. You know, I really wonder, but look, you know, migration is one of those huge questions. How do salmon and eels and even birds have never seen the place that they're migrating to? How do they suddenly all just pick up and go there?
Yes.
It's programmed in. It's within the blueprint of their DNA. Instructions, directions to a location that can not possibly in any way whatsoever be within the parameters of sight, hearing or smell.
Mm-hmm.
So how do they do that? These are the miracles of life, I think, that we don't understand. Somebody was talking to me the other day about infrasound.
Yes.
Bigfoot infrasound. Now, of course, we know that elephants have a type of infrasound, so do crocodiles. I think they say tigers possibly use it to stop their prey to immobility, although it's not being proven. And I suddenly thought, well, yeah, this would be a fantastic way to, one, prey on animals, but two, drive unwanted attention out of your habituation area, or out of the area that you're living in if you're a Bigfoot, especially if you don't want people around. I was relating it, or trying to match it, with some of these sudden feelings of dread and doom that people experienced on Ben McDui.
Yes.
That were related to the Big Green Man.
Mm.
I wonder if it could have something to do with that. Of course, you know, it's a get out of jail free card. It's sort of unprovable in a way. And if you go out into the woods all by yourself, as I have many times, even at night, you start to feel a bit scared. You're normally doing it to yourself. You know that. In that overriding fear, that's you sort of getting yourself worked up. And then, and you can even test it. You can bring yourself back down. Did the infrasound stop? Or do you just realize that you're freaking yourself out?
Yes. Yeah. I think there is a lot of that at play, because I think one of the misnomers, I think, about the great outdoors or woods especially, is that, well, it's late at night, so it's going to be quiet. And then all of a sudden, any normal animal cry you hear at 2 a.m, Andy, I think can sometimes terrify people. We've got an owl around here. And the other week, normally we hear it, no problem. The other week, it must have caught something because it was making this ungodly racket, which sounded like nothing I'd ever heard before. But it was clearly the owl because it was circling the area. So it had clearly got some lovely prey that it was chuffed to bits with, I would imagine.
Wow, I mean, and that's a weird thing, isn't it? If you've never been out into the woods or into a rural area and you heard an owl, or if, like me, before you moved to London, you never really heard foxes fighting at night, it sounds like somebody being killed, doesn't it? I literally thought the first time I came here to London, like, there's a murder happening in the street, and I ran out, and then these two foxes looked at me really guiltily and dashed off. And I thought, oh, gosh, okay, and now... Of course, if I hear it, I don't even bat an eyelid. Foxes, just foxes, killing each other out of the street. But it is spooky, and you hear all kinds of crunches and creaks and the rest of it. And as you will be in almost complete darkness when you're in the forest, that can be interpreted as being anything, you know. But which brings me on to really, I think that the subject of confirmation bias, which is a real issue in cryptozoology, especially, but it's the same with the paranormal subjects as well.
Mm.
Are we in a kind of multi-denominational faith based upon, an ambiguous concept, which is affected, the evidence of which is affected by our philosophical or pseudo-spiritual outlook or desires on what the creature should be, what position in our world it should occupy?
Mm. Mm. I think... It's one of those aspects of this that I think gets overlooked, because unless you fall down one of the numerous rabbit holes in any of these subjects, Andy, I don't think some people will comprehend just far out there some of these belief systems are, because even when we talk about Bigfoot, you've got the people who believe it's a flesh and blood creature. There are people who believe it's some kind of great ape. There are people who believe it's some kind of Neanderthal or relic hominid that's still with us. And then that's before you even consider these people that believe it's paranormal, who believe it's an alien visitor, who believe it's transdimensional. And it seems to fall sometimes into that category of, well, I can't find it, therefore it must be a ghost, or it must have gone in a, or I've seen strange lights in the sky, and then the day after there was reports of Bigfoot, and connecting two things which may be completely unrelated whatsoever.
Exactly.
It's a strange thing sometimes. I've seen some claims about Bigfoot and dogmen over the last couple of years, Andy, that I would never have even thought about 10 years ago.
Really?
from people who claim to be having conversations with them.
Oh, yeah.
Predicting election results. There is nothing off the table when you go in certain rabbit holes. It's terrifying.
Yeah, I tell you what's strange about that. You mentioned, some of the foundational figures in this genre, people like Peter Byrne, who was, this gigantic figure. But essentially, a man dedicating his life to seeking evidence of an animal from his perspective. And you have the people like Laura Coleman or, Professor Jeff Meldrum and John Green, all the people along the way, same thing with Nessie, all the great school right up to the modern day, that had theories and ideas about what these phenomena were and expressed them to people. But later, as time went on, these people became well known. These became like foundational doctrines of what Bigfoot was or what Nessie was or UFOs or anything else, basically. And we now base all of our, many of us base all of our research upon that starting point, as if that's indisputable fact, almost in the same way as if, you have a church that's got a 400-year-old organ in it and the organ's pulling the wall down and they have to take it out. And the church says, no, you can't do that. This is sacred.
Yeah.
It's not really sacred. It's just old. It's not in the Bible, is it? It's just there and the church has been there for hundreds of years and it feels like it was always there. But no, at some point, somebody put that thing in instead of paying for an entire orchestra, right? And it's the same with this genre, I think. I've started to realize, actually, a lot of what we base all of our research upon is just theories that even the people who put them forward just saying, oh, how about this? This sounds okay. What do you think of that? But now it's kind of a fact to us. And I think that's something we perhaps got to try to get away from a little bit, at least how it might influence our objectivity, and see if there's any new theories that we can throw into the mix.
Absolutely. Well, I think often it's held up, as you say there, as these are the commandments as they are. And mm-hmm. you know, you have to do everything this way, or it's the same with any aspect of Fortean research. I think that certain people, you have to use certain equipment, or you have to do certain things at certain times. Like, it's one of those things, well, why do people only search for ghosts at night? Are we, there's no evidence that ghosts only exist at night. There's thousands of people who see things in the day, never mind at night. And obviously the presumption here is that hominids are more prevalent at night. But then again, is that not simply down to the fact that there are less people and less noise about, and therefore these things are more noticeable when it's quieter?
I think you're really onto something there, especially with the ghosts. Animals perhaps might choose darker periods of the day, or at least quieter periods of the day to come out. But ghosts, I mean, why would they need the dark? Is it just that we feel more scared looking for them in the dark, so it feels more ghostly? And that's what it seems like to me. With this recent series, Weird Britain, I've been on some expeditions with some great guys. There were two chaps from the Gloucester Paranormal Group, Enpol, and I went to Little Dean Jail with them, which is this, they've got this Crime Through Time exhibition in there. It's basically all the worst things in history all over this jail, whether it's, you know, sort of Satanism, Ku Klux Klan, terrorism, you know, all the bits. It's all in there just to show what the world is capable of in something that used to be a jail and have, you know, people kept there. And so they brought their EMF meters and the Alice box and, you know, all these other bits and pieces. And it was just kind of strange in a way. Every time they spoke to the ghosts, these EMF meters lit up. Every time I spoke to the ghosts, there was nothing. And it changed. We even just changed hands, passed it back and forth. That's how different it was. And I thought, well, that's a really weird thing here. There could be an electrical signal interfering, perhaps, but, you know, we're in the same spot, me and this chap. We're just only swapping it between our hands, and he's getting a big response through the meter lighting up, and I'm getting nothing. How could this be a possibility? So I had to start to think of something else, you know. Are there parts of our own person and our belief systems, faith, if you will, that can have a physical effect, even an electrical effect upon the environment around us? Was it just a very strange moment? Because I'm not really believing in ghosts, you know. Well, not from that perspective anyway. Perhaps I don't mind that stone tape theory, you know, where some apparition is almost projected hologram-like.
Yes.
Onto the place that once walked, because the conditions are almost like a pinhole camera. You know, they're recreated right there at that moment in time. But yeah, weird.
Well, I think even in regards to that kind of aspect, once again, it's often put forward that this is the reason we have ghosts. And yet, with the greatest of respect, there is no accepted reason of why a ghost is a ghost. Because it's not just somebody that's had a tragic death. It's not just somebody from a tragic accident. We've got a myriad of apparitions that cover the whole gamut of human life, Andy. So the rules don't hold up to scrutiny once you get past about 12 different types of hauntings, really, because you suddenly think, well, that's not true. Or people say, oh, well, it must be this really famous person's ghost, when they've got no evidence of that. They just know that that famous person lived in that particular property.
Is that a little bit similar to, you know, when people have past life regression and there was somebody important, you know, that kind of thing? You're never like somebody that just like washed dishes in the kitchen. Oh, you know what? I had my past life regression, and I found out during the dynasty of Queen Cleopatra, I was a dishwasher, you know. Nobody ever says that today. And it's you know, I guess it's like an easy takedown, but it's a kind of a weird thing. Same way with the dead people. Why would people be hanging about? Now, to any of the ghost people out there, I'm not slating it, but I've noticed that depending on the religious background of the person or philosophical background of the person, and even the country they come from, the ghost is different. It behaves differently, which is another strange thing, especially if you get, and I want to try this experiment, getting people directly from different cultures and countries that have different ideas about ghosts into one well-known, very active ghost location here in the UK, and seeing, without having them talk to each other, get them in there separately, seeing what they report back. What did you experience when you're in there? See if, is it the same, or is it like vastly different because of their foundational sort of faith or philosophy or whatever it is they have in their culture?
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to think of anybody that's tried something similar. The only case that springs to my mind of where they've had more than one religious denomination try and clear something is the Humpty Doo case from Australia, Andy.
Yeah.
And I think they ended up getting down to some kind of Greek Orthodox priest turning up. Whatever it was, it didn't care what book of God you fetched in, it just threw them to the wall. It didn't really matter. Yeah. But that's an interesting idea if you could get, say, a Catholic and a Protestant and
a Hindu and a Sikh and, you know, somebody who's got Gita, the other person who's got Ganesh.
Yeah.
You know, a Muslim and a Jew and everybody, you know, even a few like animists.
Yeah.
Or, you know, Shinto, Buddhists and all these different people. Just get them all in and see is our perception of the same phenomena completely dominated by our world philosophy outlook?
Yeah. Well, clearly there is that kind of, once again, that kind of unconscious bias that whatever occurs fits into their parameters of their belief system, whatever it is. It is solely what they think it could be. They seem to be constrained to simply focus on what they know rather than what they could consider.
Yes, exactly. And if you look back at old medieval drawings of strange phenomena like sea serpents or lake monsters or even in all of these bestiaries, things like hairy men, they're always drawn as a sort of almost a patchwork animal. That's like a head of a fox and the neck of a snake and then, you know, the wings, fins of a fish, you know, or maybe a dragon's tail. And this creature, it's a composite of animals that the artist has available to him or her in their memory. And I've said, okay, well, I thank you for the description. I guess it looks something like this.
Yes. The chimera effect. Just throw
it's
anything
a chimera
at it.
Effect. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
See what sticks.
Yeah, exactly. Remember when the tale when Montezuma's men when they saw Cortez's ships coming towards them, right? And they never seen ships, so they described them as floating mountains.
Yes.
And that's the closest thing they could sort of match it with. But of course, no, a floating ship looks nothing like a mountain. That's just what they had available to describe it.
Yeah, it's your frame of reference. Absolutely. They can't create words they're not aware of, surely. Even in our great thoughts, I'm sure these things are new to someone somewhere at some point in time.
They have to be. They absolutely have to be. There has to be an origination point. And that's what's piquing my interest all the time these days. You know, I've gone from the believer perspective to the hopeful skeptic to the... This genre, I mean, is really, really weird. And there's got to be a reason I liked it in the first place and that we all want it. And how does that play out across the world, basically? Mm. And that's why I can't sleep. Or this is my life. This is my mind. I'll be up on and planning new books and that one will be called this. And that's what we'll look at. And I'm sure I'll get to it in the next 30 or 40 years.
So obviously, as you're filming the series at the minute, The Weird Britain with the team, Andy, are there some things you were not aware of or you had a very limited knowledge of, or you've come across things and you've thought, what the hell is all this about? What's going on with this?
I sort of say, really, I mean, I think I was not aware of the sheer scale of interest in alternative lifestyles and subjects in the UK. Witchcraft especially. I've met a lot of witches on this road who've made a very, very good case of sort of explaining, you know, what actually makes up their belief system and what it entails, as opposed to, you know, what we all think in society, you know, Halloween, the witches, you know, and that's been very interesting. You know, as somebody who belongs to one of the monotheistic faiths, you know, that was an interesting view into that world for me, actually, and it was delivered very respectfully, and I respect them for it. Apart from that, I think it's the massive interest in weird and unusual phenomena, especially macabre things. Because yes. The amount of museums that we went to, or prisons, that were just popular tourist centers that even like parents and kids would go to regularly to see the horror of what went on there. To me, that's a strange thing. I'm not much of a spectator for horror. Even if there's a car accident, you know, I'll try to look away until we get past it, because something in me says that person deserves their dignity, whatever the situation, and let's go on, let's move on.
Yeah.
And I feel the same, even when it's hundreds of years ago, or, you know, if I was at Pompeii looking, spectating, really, you know, at the frozen remains of these people in their last dying moments, that something would feel strangely opportunistic, perhaps, about it, you know, or exploitative.
I mean that seems to be something that we've seen a real explosion in the last sort of 10-15 years with the popularity of true crime, Andy, because there are thousands of shows out there that discuss some of the most horrific crimes you can even, well, some you can't even imagine what's gone on in some of them. But it's something that's been with us since the days of Victorian times here, when people would go to Bedlam for a day out and look at the ill people, or the furore that accompanied the Jack the Ripper cases and things like that. Yeah. And we still have it. People say, oh, well, it's just a modern thing. But it's always been happening in that kind of situation, that people seem to be drawn to the deathly, to the macabre, to the terrifying.
People used to go and watch executions, right? And
yes,
and take a picnic with the family. They literally used to do that, with witches, you know, witches being burned to death, and they'd like have a day out with it. And it was people complain about the advent of television, what it's done for society. There's been a lot fewer witch burnings. You know, and the spectators coming to execution since the dawn of television. So I think it hasn't all been bad.
No.
it's a strange thing. You know, we are weirdly drawn to it. You know, even with the tragedies we see on the TV all the time, you don't want to look at what's happened. But inevitably, you know, somebody posts something and you have a little peek, don't you? And, you know, before you know it, there's some images burned into your brain that you'll never, ever unsee. And perhaps that's, you know, one of the downsides of this tech. But, yeah, we've always wanted that. I was surprised by it. I was surprised by the people. Like, I'm always surprised when I've got a female friend who's into serial killer documentaries. I'm just like, this seems to be counterintuitive.
Yes.
In some way. But one of them explained to me, well, now I know all their tricks, you know, if I ever get preyed upon, I'll know what to do. And I said, well, that's a good point. But still, I'm more, you know, I'm more, you know, puppies and flowers, me, like, you know, meadows and streams and, you know, butterflies floating around the place. I don't think there's anything wrong with it. It's not unmanly. It's nature. It's goodness. Let's stick with that stuff. And I think generally in the Bigfoot field anyway, and cryptozoology in general, it seems to be a more genuine, I can say, I don't have any issues with the interest that people have in it, because we just want to explore the world. We want to discover animals that haven't yet been classified, or animals we thought became extinct when we find them. And I think that's, you know, that's a noble mission.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think as well, often, ironically, sometimes you can't see the wood for the trees when it comes to things like this, Andy, that people, because they're so focused on one particular thing, and I think you can apply this to all fields of the weird here, that if something else strange happens, people, if they're not looking for that strange thing, they will ignore it. And it's frustrating sometimes, especially when you've got people trekking into the middle of nowhere looking for elusive cryptids, that they would ignore signs of what we would say are normal creatures that may not supposedly live in a particular area, but are there, and people are just ignoring it. You only have to look at the chicken farmer in South Australia, I think, the other week, who thought he'd got feral cats killing his chickens. So he set a trap out, and he's caught the first quoll in the area for something like 60 years.
Yes, yes, that was amazing.
So it just shows you that you just need to, yes, be focused on what you consider to be the great prize, but don't overlook everything else you could be discovering.
Yeah, because you could really find something else by accident. I'll give you an example of that. So a good colleague of mine, Carl Marshall, originally from the CFC, expert on cryptozoology and cats, he recently collected that DNA sample in Stroud, where their Britannia team, they discovered leopard DNA. So mm-hmm. This is the first leopard DNA classified within the UK. It's a recent find. They got it, they tested it, boom, he's got it. He went to Sumatra also with, I think it was with Richard Freeman,
and yes,
his colleague, Andrew Jackson, or Geordie as we call him.
Yes.
They went to look for the Rank Pendic, and yet what he accidentally found was proof of a cryptic tiger in that area of Sumatra that's not supposed to be there. And it's known locally as a cryptid. And it's been recognized by the WWF that this is evidence of a cryptic tiger that they picked up. So his funny story about that was he thought he was chasing a Rank Pendic around a tree. They cornered it. He got around to the back of the bush just to see the orange back of something running off into the bushes, and he now believes that was the tiger. Basically ran up on a tiger and thinking it was the Rank Pendic, and luckily the tiger took fright and ran away. Otherwise, Carl wouldn't be delivering this story to us today. But but there you go, he found something just as amazing, really, in a way, just as fantastic, and yet came home empty-handed when it came to the Rank Pendic itself, sorry to say.
Well, that's the thing. I think you've got to look at that in the fact that they've discovered something remarkable. It's not what they went looking for, but they've still discovered something remarkable, which should be applauded and celebrated regardless.
Absolutely. And I would say this about the Loch Ness Monster. If we find out that the Loch Ness Monster is a 30-foot-long eel, that's still amazing.
Yes.
That's still an amazing find. I wouldn't be disappointed to know it wasn't a plesiosaur. I mean, I'm in the plesiosaur camp. I want it to be true. I desperately need it to be true. But, is it going to be true? Probably not. But if we find the 30-foot-long eel, or, a 20-foot-long sturgeon, or a Greenland shark, as Jeremy Wade proposed, living for hundreds of years, as we know they can live, in the depths of the loch, well, wow, yeah, amazing.
It would be. It would, if you find an out-of-place creature, regardless, and if, as you say there, if it's something of gigantic proportions that's never been documented before, that is still an incredible discovery. As you say, yes, it's not a plesiosaur, or, if Bigfoot was shown to be some kind of relic hominid from the Neanderthal lineage, that would still be a ground-shaking discovery. Just because it's not a giant ape doesn't mean my world falls apart. You just think, bloody hell.
Exactly. And take the win, right? I mean, that's something we've got to learn to do as paranormal researchers. Take the win. When you see that win, take it.
Yeah.
And just lean into it, because other people will. It's amazing. We were, when we went to the Loch Ness expedition recently, we were on the boat with Alan, and he's got the hydrophone in, and he captures four amazing sounds, but the memory stick isn't in, that whole thing. Also, there were some swimmers there, and we talked to these lovely people, Aya and Matty, I think the names are. They swim in glacial lakes, all around the world, these big, huge swims. They swim out from somewhere near Fort Augustus. They swim back. They get tree humps in the water. It's clearly there. You see it sink. Who knows what it is, but it was there and then it's gone. And I spoke to that lovely Japanese lady, Chi, who had her 60 pictures she'd held on to since 2018.
Yes.
And talking to her as an individual, no skin in the game, definitely did not want to come forward at all. and seeing the quality of the pictures, I'm like, oh wow, this could, for the first time I think in many years, I'm thinking this could be a reality actually, and not just some, you know, aging this middle-aged man hobby, you know, a big boy's hobby.
Yes,
that I've gotten into here and I've wasted all of my money on. This could be a real thing, and I can take back to the wife and say, see, they're real. They're really real.
Well, as you mentioned there, this is the thing about people that do have experiences, Andy, and it's often decried by naysayers and skeptics that these people are all delusional, or they're lying, or they're stupid, or they've just misidentified something, or that there is a rational explanation for it, and then they seem to just go through some horrific character assassinations of these people, and therefore I'm never surprised when you have a situation like you've just said there with Chi, that she didn't want to come forward, because you only have to look at numerous other people that have come forward with a photo or an experience that they've just been pointed at and called an idiot.
No, they really have. And really, I mean, she was lucky because she'd accidentally met Steve Feltham with another friend of his, mutual friend, at a restaurant and got talking, and she sort of confessed to him, by the way, you know, I took these pictures, I don't know what they are, I've been afraid to show them to anybody. He got a hold of them and sort of encouraged her to come forward, that he would support her, and I suppose take a lot of the brunt of the criticism with it as well, which is a nice thing to do. But you know, as I expected and everybody else expected, she was fearful of in the beginning. Of course, she'd just got nothing but non-stop harassment and abuse from lots of different quarters, you know, armchair warriors and the rest of that stuff. And just people, as we find on social media and the internet, that just would just feel better when they get online and smash somebody, you know? And that's, you know, it's a form of therapy for some people, I think. They can't start the day without smashing someone online. So, yeah, you know, that's what happened to her. But you know, luckily she had a good support structure. I'm glad that she did come out, because now I think there's some animated version of all of the clips together will be released at some point in the near future, as far as I'm aware. We'll get to see that and examine it, you know, and say, okay, is this an animate creature? Is this a real animal? Or did some kind of weird phenomena take place that we can now explain, seeing it run together in one consecutive clip?
Yeah. So obviously when you've finished with the filming, Andy, and pulling it all together and editing it into the finished product, are you going to return to the Beast of the World series? Because I know when you originally drafted it, it was running into something like 1,500 pages, wasn't it?
Yes. Oh, you heard that. Yes. So, yeah, it was over 1,500, actually. And there's actually six other volumes.
Yeah.
The second one is on water monsters. But I'm about halfway through that and halfway through another book from a new series I want to start, because I've got no sense. And a third book that I'm writing to match the series that we're doing, which will be very easy because it's just about, you know, the things we did and places we visited and the background folklore about it. That will be simple. But I'm sort of doing them both, and I've put the second Beast of the World on a hold until early next year, at least, I think. I want to get this other one out, which is in the Beastly Theories series, actually.
Yeah.
And that's going to be going off of cryptozoology. Then the first one will be a cryptid book, very different to the other books. And then all of the following books are going to be really diverse, because I love cryptozoology and it's been my passion for many, 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 many years. But I'm just too curious a person to just stay on it. I think I'll do like one new book on it every year and a half. I'll be happy with that. And in the meantime, there's some of the subjects I'd really, really like to get embroiled in.
Intriguing. Anything that springs to mind that you want to immerse yourself in more?
Well, I'm absolutely obsessed with megaliths, you know?
Yes.
I love megaliths. I love being around them. I just love the whole, all of the theories and ideas around how they came to be where they are. We were recently at Avebury, Infrastructure circle that a lot. People don't really think about it because Glastonbury's the rock star, right?
Yeah.
And we met the head druid there, a lovely guy named Hank, and he took us around and told us about the stones, or at least what they believe about the stones and their different purposes. And one of the things that really stood out to me is all of the different reasons people seem to come up to them and want to be around them. I have no idea whether it's anything to do with their initial purpose, whether the Wiccans who stay there with them or the druids, the modern druids who now sort of, I suppose, manage a lot of the activity around them, whether they're right or not, or whether they've just grown up over the years and attached themselves to them. Who even knows? But one thing's for sure, you know, it's an impressive activity, an impressive monument that exists all around the world. And that's an even bigger link than even something like pyramids or Bigfoot sightings or dragons and lake monsters. Stone markers, you know, monoliths all around the world for strange, unknown reasons. And why did we do it? I want to find out.
It is fascinating because, I mean, we've got a few of them here in the Peak District, Andy. Mm. One of my favourites is the Nine Ladies Stone Circle, which is supposed to depict a group of women who danced on the Sabbath and so were turned to stone.
Oh, there's something like that in, in Dartmoor, I think, the Hurling Stones.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
So they are fascinating, and when I recently went up to Cumbria, we went and visited, because I'm the same as you. I've got to, wherever I go, I just look for where the weird things are near, and just try and visit them. So we went up to Castlerigg, which is another incredible stone circle, primarily because of its location. It's on this rise, so it's surrounded by these beautiful, when we went, these beautiful misty mountains all around you, so you feel kind of as though you're touching the sky. It is a remarkable thing if the weather is in the right direction for you to be able to feel as though everything you're close to heaven, I suppose, or whatever they wished it to be. But I just find them jaw dropping, and I even just by touching them, you just try and comprehend, why is this here? What was it here for? What did it mean to these people? Why was this place so special? And that on its own takes you into a whole realm of thoughts and projections of what the possibilities could be. They're endless.
I think they really are. And as with many other things, the finding out is always more fun than the knowing.
Yes.
You know, I'm sure once we find Bigfoot or Nessie, and they're just like the Kraken of old, you know, the giant squid in formaldehyde in the museum somewhere, we'd be like, oh, look, Yeti, you know, as you pass by. Have you seen the Yeti yet? Oh, they've got one in the London Museum. We have seen them before. It's fine. And, you know, that's what we're looking at. Whenever I see a giant squid in the museum, I'm like, that's the Kraken. And nobody cares. Nobody cares at all that that's the Kraken. Here it is, you know, ready to destroy Argos. it's one of these weird things. I just wonder, will it be like that one day if we find these things? Mm. And that also makes me worried about finding them in a way.
Mm. Well, this is often the question I think people don't comprehend when we talk about these creatures, Andy, is, well, what if you find it? What's next?
Run.
Well, it depends if you've got your pheromone spray on you, then you are in trouble, I think.
Well, yeah, exactly. Run faster, exactly. Or, you know, submit, whichever you think is the more...
Just don't be the slowest. That's all you need to worry.
Don't be the slowest, yeah. Or the most attractive. just get out of that. Yeah. I'm working hard on not being the most attractive now. So it's a middle-aged thing, isn't it? You know, I think you said you've turned 50 recently, didn't you? And, I'm not there yet, but I'm fast approaching. I'm only 3 years away, or 2.5. And it's just one of those things, those weird things. As we get on, we get older, we realize that there's more and more to know and that we don't know. And I would just like to at least investigate one or two of these interesting things. You know, before the lights go out, so to speak, you know, before it's all over, like I'm not fit enough to do it or whatever else happens along the way. And life is quick, it's fleeting, moves really fast. You're probably 50 before you even knew it.
Mm.
And I feel the same way about where I am right now. And that's why I would suggest to anybody out there, if you want to do something, go and do it. Don't think, well, that costs money or that takes time. Just do it, you know, because you'll get the money back. And the time was always worth it.
Absolutely. Live for today, because none of us know what tomorrow may bring. And we all know enough our personal lives of people that perhaps didn't grasp the opportunities when they had them and then unfortunately were unable to do so for whatever reason.
Yes. May they rest in peace. And it's just, it's just one of these things, you know. You're slaving away at the office to get the new car with the 1,000-pound rims or whatever the rubbish is. And that could get you a thermal camera. and a trip to Alberta in Canada or whatever, you know.
Mm.
And, the trip of a lifetime with some nice group of people out there where you may get a change of perspective. Who knows?
Yeah. So is there one place you've yet to visit in regards to cryptids, Andy, that you'd love to go to that's on that bucket list? You know, obviously, I've been fortunate enough to visit Loch Ness, and you've obviously spent a lot of time up there. Is there anywhere that you've yet to go that you really want to try and get to?
There's many, many, many places. I would like to go to the Shenandoah Forest to look for the Yeren.
Mm-hmm.
Look at the Yeren sightings there with perhaps one of their local experts or somebody that's been studying it a long time. I think I would also like to go to Lake Ikeda in Japan. I think they said they solved it with some sort of giant eel, but I'd like to see the giant eel regardless.
Mm.
That's what it is. In the North American terms, I'm not actually sure anymore. I think it feels so saturated to me that it's hard to take it seriously. I know people are having very genuine sightings over there, but there's such an industry around it. It's hard to sort of accept anything as being completely genuine, I suppose.
Mm.
Pacific Northwest, I think. Or Skunk Ape, Florida.
Yeah.
I suppose Florida, Skunk Ape, or even Pinky, you know, the
yes.
Lake, yes, the water monster of the the Everglades would be nice. One more place. Oh, it would probably have to be the Himalayas, wouldn't it?
We'd have to.
But I would dress up as Peter Cushing from the Abominable Snowman. And I'd sequester myself looking for strange orchids and plants in a local monastery and sort of try to get it all started that way. That's the way it wanted to happen.
Yes. Yes. One of my favourites, an overlooked Hammer classic.
Oh, one of the best movies. All of their early movies were better than their later movies somehow. Mm.
Yeah.
Strange, apart from perhaps The Vampire Lovers, 1970. Yes. You know, awesome, amazing. And the second movie they did, which is Brides of Dracula, which Christopher Lee is not in,
but
is a classic. It's almost as good as the first Horror of Dracula, or Dracula as we call it.
Mm.
Amazing. Devil Rides Out, another classic.
Yeah.
You know, apart from that, most of the other Dracula movies were abhorrent. They were terrible. We just watched them because we like Chris Lee and Peter Cushing, right?
Yeah, very much so.
Growing up, reruns of Channel 4, 2 a.m. on a Friday morning or Saturday morning.
Yeah. Still happens at my house on a Friday night, Andy.
I've got them all. A DVD.
Yeah.
Everything. Even, obviously, to stream just in case the DVDs crap out.
Well, Andy, it's been a real pleasure speaking with you, my friend. Where can everybody find your work, listen to your podcast, and keep up to date with whatever you've got going on, sir?
If you can all find me on Facebook, it's the easiest place. It's just facebook.com/beastlytheories. Although if you get onto Linktree at any point, the Linktree.com/beastlytheories, every single project I'm in is there, linked up on there. The book, Beasts of Britain, Hairy Humanoids, that's the Beast of the World series, they're available on every bookseller, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Waterstones, wherever you go, it'll be there. And Beastly Theories, again, it's on all of the, similarly to this wonderful podcast, it's on all of the main platforms. Spotify is my preferred one, that's where I normally find it, but if you're on like iTunes or Apple, it's there as well.
Marvellous. Well, thank you again for joining me. It's been a real pleasure having a chat with you and chewing the cryptid fat for a while with you, sir. Thank you for joining me. Hopefully it won't be our last conversation, and I wish you all the best.
It's been wonderful, and I hope to be back soon.